Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good evening. This is a special post-election live call-in episode of United States of Anxiety, which is a podcast election series that WNYC and the Nation produced. It documents the experiences and perspectives that informed voters in their choice for president. I'm Kai Wright from The Nation magazine. So, okay, the Obama era is winding down, like it or not, and it ends how it began, with widespread anxiety about economic opportunity and equality. So in this hour, we're going to try to take stock of where things stand as we move into a Trump administration. But we're not going to look at GDP and stocks and that kind of thing. We want to zero in on the two big things that have preoccupied millions of people over the past 8 years: jobs and what happens in their absence, poverty. So let's first lay down the markers for the Trump era. A lot of people, myself included, quite honestly, were really critical of how Obama dealt with the Great Recession. Some say he did the wrong stuff. Some say he did the right stuff, but not enough of it. But in September, Obama got a report card that's pretty striking. According to the Census Bureau, over the last couple of years, we've seen one of the most remarkable recoveries on record. And I just want to tick off a few of the big takeaways there because they're actually quite eye-popping. From 2014 to 2015, median household income grew more than it has in any year on record. That was true for all racial and ethnic groups. And it was actually true, most true, at the bottom of the income ladder. Poverty also fell by more than it had since 1968. And again, that was in all racial and ethnic groups and all demographics. Now, the flip side is that we still have more people living in poverty than any time since we began counting. So what gives? What does all this mean in real life? And here to help me answer that question are Mo George. She directs organizing for the New York chapter of Community Voices Heard. Hi, Mo.
Hi, Guy. How are you?
And joining us on the phone is Joel Berg. He's the CEO of Hunger Free America. Hello, Joel.
Hello.
And listeners, we want to have you in this conversation. How did the economy treat you in the Obama years? Call us 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Did your economic situation improve or deteriorate? And what do you think made that happen? 212-433-9692. And you can also tweet us your comment at WNYC. So, Mo, let's start with you. What about your members at Community Voices Heard over these past 8 years? In this recovery that I just described, mm-hmm. what are you seeing amongst them? What kind of experiences have they had?
So I think a lot of it has varied around generational and class, right? To be honest. So, you know, we work with low-income New Yorkers, and if you talk to massive amount of my members, they will tell you that they haven't seen any massive increases in their income over the 2 years. And some may have seen a raise here and there, but it quickly got eaten up by the high cost of housing or transportation. But then you have, you know, some of my, you know, friends like myself who have been able to afford college and things like that, who have seen a shift in their actual salary, right? They're not my members of CVH, but they have seen a shift in their salary. And to the point where a lot of them have said, you know what, there's a shift in my salary, you know, I can afford something more, and actually have decided to relocate out of New York, weirdly. I kind of don't get that. But I think also for them, it was like, you know what, I want to actually have something and I can't here in New York.
Right.
Like I can make a good salary, but what does that matter if I can't buy a home?
So there's a shift in, not at the bottom.
Yeah, there was no shift at the bottom. I think if I said that, I think my members will choke me tomorrow. Yeah, because they look at it like, you know, they're still struggling to pay bills. A lot of them have to still decide whether to, you know, between buy food or pay for medical expenses, you know, even with Obamacare. And some of them have to deal with, you know, two or three jobs, the anxiety of having two or three jobs just to maintain, you know, rents that have been exorbitant, right? So they don't see, you know, they were happy, don't get me wrong, they were very happy about the election of Obama the first 4 years and even these last four, but I don't think they felt any of, like, a shift, you know?
Joel, what about you? What have you seen in particularly these last 2 years? Have you been able to see a sign of this recovery that the Census Bureau says we've had?
Well, I think you're seeing the beginning of the edges of rays of hope of a potential recovery. But we've accepted the new normal. Nationwide, before the recession, about 35 million Americans lived in homes that couldn't afford enough food. It shot up to nearly 50 million. This year, as the poverty rate went down, it went down to about 42 million Americans living in homes that can't afford enough food, really struggling against hunger. But that's a horrible new normal we've accepted, that the number of people in America who are essentially hungry is bigger than the population of California and Kentucky combined. Here in New York City, we're about to release new hunger numbers, and we're going to show that there has not been a significant reduction yet in New York City. We certainly know the homeless population hasn't gone down, so we've stemmed the increases in the bleeding a little, and certainly progressive policies have made it much less bad than it would have been, but I think it was a problem when the Democrats were trying to tell people everything's great, when they should have said, well, things still stink, but the other side would make it stink worse.
Well, it's a really hard argument to make, you know, that you're proving a negative, right? That this is the problem. Mm-hmm.
It is, but when you try to convince people whose lives suck that things don't suck, that's a harder argument to make.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's get some callers in here. Kristen in Morris County, New Jersey. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm a social worker in New Jersey. My husband's a GM of a restaurant, and we struggle. We are one of those classic middle-class families who are paycheck to paycheck. We admittedly have some debt, but at the same time, who doesn't? But I've seen both sides of it. I think we're hurting because we can't move forward with some of our goals. As for small businesses, the effects of Obamacare has been horrible. Horrible. My husband works for a place that has over 50 employees, but under 100, and they are getting killed. An amazing fact that I found out being so close to it was that even if somebody turns down the insurance that the employer is providing, they still have to pay a portion for the insurance, whether the person actually accepts it or not. So in fact, it's almost like a double payment, because if the person goes to the emergency room, they say they have no insurance, they get the care that they need, but then at the same time, they do not have, the employer is still paying the government for the insurance.
So Kristen, I'm not
a crazy little fact there. But on the flip side, I'm a social worker. And I see what Obamacare has done also, good and bad. And I really don't see the effect. Too much positive has come for the average Medicaid person. And the major problem that I've seen with, especially in New Jersey, where people make a lot of money, what it looks like to be a lot of money on paper. And so therefore, these people are expected to pay for their insurance now that they can't afford, especially in New Jersey. They can't afford it. People who are blue-collar workers who make 36, 46, $1,000, it sounds like a lot of money, but in New Jersey, it's next to nothing.
So thank you for that, Kristen. Let me ask you on, I guess there's no way to have this conversation without Obamacare coming up. Medicaid expansion was considered a huge poverty program, really. How does that play out in the economic lives and these hunger questions that you issues that you were just raising? If Medicaid is goes away in a new Congress,
it would dramatically increase hunger. And what many of the critics of Obamacare have, unfortunately, is amnesia about how bad things were before. Your previous caller, most of the conditions she said predated Obamacare and were worse under Obamacare. And again, I think the Democrats made a huge substantive and strategic mistake in not saying, gee, there are a lot of problems with this program, but it used to be worse, and it would have been better if we had our way and got a public option. So there's still many problems, but it was far worse. We're the only industrialized Western nation on the planet that doesn't ensure adequate health care for all its citizens, and huge bills for health care. She said, oh, someone's going to go to a hospital emergency room and get services for free. That's partially true. They'll usually have a huge bill at the end that could sink them in debt for a long, long time. And then when people don't get health care, it's harder for them to work and they become more poor. And so there's no question that the screwed up lack of health care in America contributes significantly to poverty and hunger.
Okay, let's go to Harry in Forest Hills, New York. Harry, welcome to WNYC.
Sure. Hi, how you doing? The story, the way I see it, I had a business which went under right after 9/11. I had started it. And after Obama became president, it's sort of like I was sitting on pins and needles along with others. I guess from business size, we would be considered non-existent. I was a sole operator. At times, I'd hire independent people, part-timers. But I noticed that every time Congress did not agree on a balanced budget, which was for a period of 3 years, the sales would drop. After the Bush crash, my sales dropped 60%. Then they drop other percentage points, and it reached a point where the money I had accrued, I had to start paying for rent and other services, and then it just reached the point where it slipped out from under me. So the first 2 to 4 years of Obama's administration, I would largely blame on a gridlocked Congress. I was not selling necessities. I was selling media entertainment items, you know, DVDs, books, etc. And I was in touch with other sellers. They all had the same thing. I was in touch with people selling jewelry items. So the non-necessity people,
Harry,
we got slammed.
Harry, can I ask you about the last couple of years? You know, with this idea, we're told by the Census Bureau that household income, median household incomes went up. People got more jobs. Presumably, that would lead to more spending. Did you see a change then in these last couple of years?
I'm semi-retired, but I am in touch with other people, and there are other things that are killing them. I'm glad you had mentioned that, because food prices are going up disproportionately to any increase, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that we are exporting more food. We are also feeding China. China does not trust their own food supply. I am an oatmeal eater, and Chinese have discovered that instead of eating rice porridge, they would rather eat oatmeal. The international export price, like if it's $1 a pound internally, and all of a sudden an international market opens up and they can get $2 a pound, they will start charging us $2 internally, and that has to be addressed by Congress, being that we do pay agricultural subsidies. Also, China has bought half of the Smithfield Ham company. So they are using the nutrients of our soil and shipping it overseas to feed another population.
So
food we're being nickel and dimed to death is what it boils down to. It's sort of like a big picture brushstroke. I'm going to add to this. It's great to deal with minutia because David versus Goliath, we have to do that. But we are living in a technological feudalism because the former Chinese Communist Party, they are now the new royalty. Putin is a czar, and I think we've just elected a czar.
Well, I'm going to stop you there, Harry, because we do it. We don't get a bunch of other calls, but thank you for calling in. This is the United States of Anxiety from WNYC and The Nation magazine. I'm Kai Wright. Our number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Quickly, Mo, there was a couple of things in Harry there. It sounds like he would support all of the concerns about Trump's feelings about us turning America away to foreigners. But mm-hmm. I also hear this point about rising costs, that if there was a – and I've heard you talk about this. Even if there's a – if there was an increase in incomes, costs are going up.
Tell me
a little bit of how that looks for your members.
So I think, our members, we have a lot of members who live in areas that are fastly gentrifying, right? So case in point, we've done a lot of work in Holmes Tower, which is on 96th and 1st, between 96th and 92nd, around that 1st. There are supermarkets there. There's a Whole Food there, and there are a number of the supermarkets there, but actually a supermarket that members can actually stretch their dollar, they don't feel that, right? There would be a Pathmark that was once a Pathmark on 125th that they actually would go to from 92nd Street all the way up to 125th Street because they felt like they could get more for, their budget. And then that supermarket closed. So then now they're forced to actually have to go to the supermarkets in their area, right? Yeah, the quality of the food is better, but they can't stretch the amount of money. Right. So that means for them, if they really want to stretch it, they have to go clear across, Manhattan to find a more economical supermarket. And then the cost to actually travel now across from where you are on 1st to somewhere possibly either 6th or 7th or 8th to find a supermarket that allows you to stretch your dollar, adds up. Especially for, a lot of my members who have kids, right, and can't afford to be, using constantly your Metro card to traipse clear across Manhattan just to make sure that you can spread 70 or 80 bucks, of food.
Yeah. So I want to read, we got a couple of tweets coming in, both about college-related stuff. So from Zaza Chilvers, I hope I got your name pronounced right there, Zaza, I'm sorry, says, we're white middle class in Connecticut, had to work super hard but recovered, in better shape now. What's killing us is $70,000 a year in college tuition. Orianella Windsor says, the economy was actually pretty awesome for me while I was in college in 2010-ish. I was able to get a job and afford textbooks. So there's a couple people that are seeing some things. Lily in East Northport, Long Island. I understand that you also have seen some improvement. Welcome to WNYC, Lily.
I did actually see quite a bit of improvement. Not any that's been really discussed. Just to disclose, I'm trans, and 8 years ago, there were still a lot of areas where I could be fired just for being me. And as a result, I felt rather restricted to certain companies where more larger companies that frequently didn't pay very well, not a lot of room for improvement or advancement. And since the general feeling as well has changed, I felt I can go out into the workforce, get a different job. I now work in IT. I've helped land a few contracts for my company, and I've gotten a raise recently. So things have improved enormously.
Congratulations.
And, I guess I'm a little worried of how things would go under a Trump presidency.
Yeah, it's interesting, Lily, because we don't have a conversation about we talk about rights and the rights question, and we rarely connect it to economic opportunity and economic hardships. So what do you fear will happen for you in a Trump administration? How do you think it would turn around the success that you feel like you've seen?
My concern is that those protections would be reversed or repealed, and I would kind of have this daily dread that at any point I could just lose my job for being me, mm-hmm. and not have any recourse, not be able to do anything about it, and essentially have to go back to looking for specific companies that are accepting of it.
Thank you for that testimony, Lily. Mo, you were nodding while Lily was talking. Amongst your members, do you see a lot of this, the questions? You know, Lily's talking about being trans, but mm-hmm. there's a whole bunch of different categories of people who are concerned about their yeah. rights under the Trump administration. Do people connect that to their what might happen to them economically as well?
Definitely. So, you know, we are statewide, right? So as we go across the state, you know, definitely our Westchester and Orange and Dutchess County chapters are having these discussions, right, around what will that look like for folks. Our chapters as we go, you know, across New York State, we have a lot of immigrants. We have a lot of undocumented immigrants. We have a lot of low-wage workers who are working in, like, supermarkets there and thinking, like, will that continue, right? You know, this, you know, the state has talked about $15 an hour, but not till 2019. And what is that mean?
$15 an hour, like, for minimum
15,
wage.
Exactly. But not until 2019. And what does that look like, right? And what will happen if these industries that actually, you know, employ low-income workers are gone, right? Or certain plants that actually are able to, you know, hire some undocumented workers, what will that happen, right? Or pick up day laborers, what, you know, then are they now having to fear that they can't gather to just get work for the day because there'll be raids or, you know, and thus not being able to feed their families? So those are all concerns that, you know, folks have, right, around. And then let's be honest, right, even for folks of color, right, because the blatantness of people's anger and it being okay, you know, remiss not to say that folks of color aren't scared that they would be fired for just being black. Mm. Like, that's a real conversation
people have.
People
license
are having.
To behave
exactly.
However they want to behave.
And then we're supposed to tolerate that under, you know, the auspice, like, I need a job, you know?
So let's go to Dennis in East Brunswick, New Jersey. I understand you have a different take on Obamacare than we've heard.
Yeah, hello.
Yes. Hello, Dennis.
Yep. Yes. I own a small business. There's a couple takes I've got. And we've actually been doing really well the last few years, as opposed to, you know, climbing out of the recession. Yeah, we had a little rough spots. But we work in a lot of people's homes, and I judge the economy by price complaint. And it's not that it's not existent. It's just it's not like we can get anything we want for it, but we're not getting complaint about what we need to get paid for our work. But on also, we've had health care all along. In the last few years, we got into a silver plan or whatever the heck it is through Obamacare, through our Blue Cross, Blue Shield. And it's working out for us. We don't have anybody severely sick and whatnot. But our rates actually went down last year. Now, this year, they did tick up 6%. But prior to that, we were looking at 20 and 30% increases. One year, we got an 80% increase. Prior to, you know, the implementation of Obamacare. And every year we had to do this song and dance and switch plans and pay more for prescriptions and you know, sacrifice coverage. And I think it'd be a real shame if we turn and go the other direction. I think it's got good protections. Of course, we need to get everybody participating in it, just like in New Jersey when car insurance wasn't mandatory. You know, premiums were crazy. You know, but in New Jersey, most populous state, premiums really aren't that bad for car insurance anymore, of course, unless you're getting out of high school. But, you know, I think it's a good thing. I think for them to come in and say they're going to repeal something and they really have no idea what they're going to replace it with would be a major mistake. You know, I think we need more participation in health insurance. I think we need to move away from for-profit insurers. I think that's a freaking pitfall. You know, it just doesn't make sense. We're talking about people's lives here, and to profit on them and worry about what the stock market thinks is a shame.
So thank you for that, Dennis.
I think the economy's doing great. We're all for the Obamacare. Even if we were single payer, we'd go for that too. And we're blue collar workers to the bone, but we don't buy into what we think is coming down.
Okay.
Throwing out the baby with the bathwater, you know?
Thank you for that, Dennis. Obamacare is a popular topic. I guess this is that people, we forget that this is an economic program, Obamacare. We have a tweet from David Sorrell. I'm sorry, David. Well, I hope it's Sorrell. In any case, here's what David has to say. Obamacare's age 26 provision gave me some cushion that I didn't have to worry about. The economy did struggle, but it's not the 90s, so which I take it to mean that he had a hard time in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing, was that young people were able to get some coverage that helped them not have to worry about it. All right, so Neville in Suffern, New York, also has something to say about Obamacare, I understand.
Yeah, hi. My name's Neville. I'm a physician, and the 20 million people that are now insured, one of the things that people don't realize is that an enormous amount of new money has come into hospitals that formerly took care of people without insurance. I see patients in a hospital, large hospital in New York City, and many of the patients that I would see in the past, I don't know, 10-15% of the patients had no insurance, and now it's very unusual for me to see somebody with no insurance. Many of them have Medicaid or some either New York State Medicaid or some other kind of Medicaid. And what's happened with Obamacare is that it's shifted monies from small businesses, I presume, and also from the state government and some of the federal government to the hospitals. And these hospitals are going to fight tooth and nail before they let Obamacare be turned down without some sort of subsidy. And then just the other comment is just to remind everybody that in the United States, we spend 12% of our healthcare dollars on administration. And that's compared to 2% in Canada, for example. And while people like to compare one party, I know this is not really the topic, but one-payer systems are often compared to countries that really do have somewhat inferior medical care, but they spend half the money that we do. If we were to spend close to the same amount of money and have a one-payer system and save that 10%, the health care would be incredible.
Thank you for that, Neville. Joel, I want to ask you quickly. So we're talking about Obamacare, but more broadly, sort of the safety net provisions of the last 8 years in terms of thinking about poverty and what help people both stay in and come out of poverty. How important have those been, and what are your thoughts about what we face, what folks will face on safety nets in a Trump administration?
The safety net has been absolutely critical. I still believe the greatest way to reduce poverty is to have job creation, living wages, and broad-based economic growth. But when that's not enough, the safety net's absolutely critical. The growth of the SNAP program, the new name for the food stamps program, that occurred during the recession, as much as that was beaten up on by the right, and they race-baited over that, the fact of the matter is it prevented us from having mass starvation, like in the developing world with the greatest economic collapse in 70 years. And so you can't underestimate that. And the cuts that have been implemented over the last few years, pushed for by the Republicans, but I hate to say, acceded to by Democrats, $14 billion of cuts nationwide have resulted in devastation in New York City. Today, the SNAP program in New York City is spending $500 million less than just a few years ago. $500 million less, that dwarfs all the charities put together. So the safety net on food, on housing, on health care, to the degree that there's limited support for child care, is absolutely vital. And we're scared to death that Trump is basically going to outsource his domestic agenda to Paul Ryan, who's been chomping at the bits for years to dismantle programs for low-income people and working people to fund more tax cuts for the mega-rich.
Like what? What would be the first thing or the most concerning thing that would come undone?
Right now, they're even going after school meals yet again. The right just can't help themselves. The House of Representatives is pushing a school meals bill that would make it harder for low-income kids to get school meals and put junk food back in the schools. That's number one. And number two, they're chomping at the bits to go after the SNAP program, the food stamps program, turn it over to the states and allow the states to spend money on other things instead of feeding hungry people. So again, they can, you know, pay for more tax cuts for the rich.
Mo, you're going to get the last word. What what is there anything about a President-elect Trump and the incoming administration that makes you say, okay, well, you know what, on poverty for my members, the things that I'm seeing for my members, here's might be something that might work out for us. Is there anything in that?
I know that's a real question. And, you know, so there's a, let's be honest, like we've had these conversations, right, with some of our members informally, and we're going to have more formal conversations as, you know, as we lead up to the holidays. But, you know, people don't have, you can only go by what you see, right? Because it's not like he held any political office or has done anything outside of being a developer in New York City that you could sort of gauge. So, and then if you look at the, what, last 18 months of him running, you really, like, when you talk to my members, they don't hold out any hope, right? So they don't hold any hope that, you know, this is not the person that they see, that, you know, that he's not going to, you know, have Muslims register, that he's really a fan of the African Americans or the blacks, or like they don't hold any of that hope. What they hold is real sincere fear, and not only of his rhetoric and policies, but also fear of folks that are like diehard fans of his that act out in his name, in real ways. So they don't have, you know, like from the conversations we've had, they don't have hope. And, you know, they actually feel insulted that people say, oh, you should wait and see. You know what I mean? They're like, you know, one member was like, you know, I'm sure somebody said that about Hitler. And I was like, oh, but you're right.
It's a big comparison. But for some people, I don't have time to wait and see. That's what it sounded like Lily was saying.
That's exactly what the member was trying to say. Like, you know, they said the same thing. And, you know, they're not down for that.
So I got to end it there. We'll be back. Mo, my thanks to Mo George from Community Voices Heard and Joel Berg, CEO of Hunger Free America. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to a special post-election live call-in episode of the United States of Anxiety, WNYC and the nation's election series that documents the experiences and perspectives that informed voters and their choices for president. I'm Kai Wright from The Nation. We'll be back.
This is a special post-election call-in episode of the United States of Anxiety, WNYC and the nation's election series that documents the experiences and perspectives that informed voters and their choice for president. You can hear the entire United States of Anxiety series at wnyc.org/anxiety and leave a comment letting us know what's on your mind during this divisive time. United States of Anxiety is also available as a podcast. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or on the WNYC app.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Post-election live call-in episode of the United States of Anxiety, WNYC and The Nation magazine's election series that documents the experiences and perspectives that inform voters and their choices for president. I'm Kai Wright from The Nation magazine. So Donald Trump has taken multiple positions on all kinds of issues over the course of his public life, but perhaps the area where he's been the most consistent has been his critique of free trade, or at least the way it's been handled. He thinks trade deals are bad and take jobs away from American workers. He thinks American companies that send jobs overseas should be subject to some form of punishment, notwithstanding his own offshoring deals. And he thinks that we need to bring traditional manufacturing back to the U.S. in order to help what he calls the forgotten man in our globalizing economy. So, how realistic is all of this? And does it even make sense for the job market we have right now? I'm joined by Ben Castleman. He's a senior editor and the chief economics writer at 538. Hello, Ben.
Hello there. So nice to be on.
And I'm also joined by Karen Nussbaum. She's the executive director of the group Working America. They're the community affiliate of the AFL-CIO, which tries to organize workers who are not unionized. Hello, Karen.
Hey, Kai.
And so, listeners, we want you in this conversation as well. What do you stand to gain or lose in the Trump economy? Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Are you scared of a trade war, or are you optimistic that the situation will improve under Donald Trump's leadership? 212-433-9692, and you can also tweet your comment to us at WNYC. So, Karen, let's start with you. And I guess looking back, we began this hour talking about some of the recovery we saw in the last 2 years of the Obama presidency. What progress, if any, do you feel like working people made during the Obama years?
Well, I think there's undeniable progress, but I think that, you know, the unemployment went down, the job market tightened. The wages started going up through and the enormously successful minimum wage campaigns that took place all across the country. But I also think that part of what we saw in the field, and we talked to a million voters this year, was that in a way the nature of the recovery after the recession almost sealed the deal on the despair for a lot of working class people, that there were just not, you have to be both advantaged and lucky to land a good job anymore. And so you've got a better economy, but a better economy that still skews so high and leaves everybody out. And that's what a lot of people were voting on.
Yeah. Ben, you wrote an article just yesterday titled "Trump's Proposals Won't Help the White Working Class or the Urban Poor," which would suggest that that the description that Karen just offered is not going to get any better. Why not? What were you telling us in that article?
Well, so I think it's so interesting to see what Donald Trump ran on, right? We know that he didn't really run on a whole lot of specificity in terms of policy, right? A lot of what he was running on was this feeling of despair, which is, I think, exactly what we're hearing about here. And I think that, you know, there are very real concerns that a lot of voters had about the state of the economy and especially sort of how the economy has worked for them. And I think that's exactly right. The problem is that he hasn't really offered policies that are likely to do anything about that. You know, the narrative coming out of the election has been that this was somehow sort of the revenge of the white working class against elites. Well, the stock market has rallied the last few days, which suggests that the elites are not terribly concerned about what Donald Trump is going to do to them. And there's really very little reason to think that most of the actual policies that he's proposed are going to do very much either for the white working class or for people of color or the working class and the poor and the low-income Americans, both in cities and in suburban areas and then in rural America where Trump drew so much of his support. You know, the policies proposed are dealing with trade and immigration. You know, I think we'll probably get into that in a little bit more detail, but there's not much reason to think that the policies he's proposing are going to help much there. He didn't embrace sort of traditional Democratic approaches to dealing with that, raising the minimum wage, expanding worker protection, expanding overtime eligibility, as the Obama administration has done. But he also didn't embrace many of the sort of more creative ideas that have come out of the conservative wing of the Republican Party, focusing on the earned income tax credit, some of the ideas that Paul Ryan has brought out. And so you sort of have him talking a lot about these concerns, but not necessarily proposing much in the way of policy that would actually do anything about it.
Actually, on that point, before I get to callers, I want to ask you to, because you've also written about this idea that, you know, we're not bringing back manufacturing jobs. They're gone. And that you would like to hear from both sides of the aisle something more about how do we make the jobs people have better. It sounds like you're getting to that in your I guess, bipartisan critique of Donald Trump's proposals.
No, I think that's right. You know, we hear Donald Trump talk all the time about the forgotten people, and there's a grain of truth to that. But to some extent, I think, you know, manufacturing workers, these kinds of jobs are the least forgotten people in terms of the way that politicians talk about this. Right? They talk endlessly about manufacturing. They love to have photo ops in factories, and they love to talk about the return of manufacturing. And you know, the reality in this country is, you know, we can talk about whether there are changes in trade policy that would, you know, make some difference on the margin. But we are not going to go back to a manufacturing-dominated economy. We, you know, haven't had that for a long time. A stat I love to throw out there is that in 1994, there were 3.5 million more Americans working in manufacturing than in retail. And today, those numbers are almost exactly reversed. There are 3.5 million more people working in retail than in manufacturing. And sort of no amount of trade war or tariffs or controls on immigration are going to change that. And so then the question is not how do you bring back manufacturing jobs, if that's a pipe dream. It's how do you make sure that the 80% of workers who work in some form of service industry, how do you make jobs better for them? How do you replace the what we think of as manufacturing? Right? The reason we glamorize manufacturing is not because there's anything unique about working in a factory floor. It's because these were well-paying jobs that offered benefits, that offered some stability, that offered opportunities for people without a college degree. There's no inherent reason that that can't exist in the service sector, but we haven't built in the protections to make that possible. And meanwhile, the manufacturing jobs that we do have in many ways gotten worse. The median wage for a manufacturing worker is now lower than for workers overall. So there's sort of no magic to manufacturing. The question is, how do we make jobs better for everybody?
Okay, I want to get some callers in here in this conversation. Murph from Newtown, Connecticut. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, guys.
How you doing?
Great. Well, what I wanted to say, I mean, it ties into what you guys are talking about, but it's a little different. What I feel like we stand to lose in the Trump economy is a lot of the incentives that are pushing renewable energy right now. Or conversely, maybe we, you know, the government creates a lot of incentives for fossil fuels. You know, that's something that scares me. Now, when we talk about factory jobs or middle-class jobs, et cetera, leaving America or industries dying, Trump is going around promising the coal industry, I will save coal, I'll bring back these jobs. I mean, that's the last thing anybody should be trying to do. What we should be trying to do is create infrastructure projects, and I think renewable energy is a perfect outlet for infrastructure projects, obviously, in addition to bridges, roads, et cetera, for those kinds of workers, that section of the economy, to be repurposed for something productive. I'm really afraid that now that progress that we were kind of, you know, slowly moving towards now is going to peter out. We might go in the wrong direction when it comes to how do we repurpose that segment of the economy.
Thanks for that, Murph. Karen, this has been Murph's talking about something that was really a part of the campaign. And it's the question of like whether the Democrats actually had something to say to that part of the economy he's describing about repurposing them and how they would be part of an economic future. There's now this infrastructure package that's on the table from Trump. In your work and the folks you're talking to, help us understand how it's coming from their perspective.
Well, in 2008, I remember being out in the field and talking about green jobs to folks, and they were really excited about it. And those jobs didn't emerge, and if they did, they didn't emerge to be the kind of jobs that Ben talked about. And I agree with Ben that there's nothing about factory work that makes factory work well paid. It was that it was organized. It used to be the worst jobs until they got organized. And the same thing is true. This is about the distribution of profit and whether productivity is rewarded. It has nothing to do with the inherent nature of the job. Low-paid jobs are paid low because that's what employers pay, and it's only through organization that you actually restore good jobs, good pay, stability, benefits, as Ben was saying. And and the same thing will be true for renewable energy and that jobs. I do believe that we need to try to incentivize that. I think that we need to create jobs that
are good jobs, but we also have to, as a community, support the notion that workers need to be organized, or else there is no way to keep family standards, living standards up.
Yeah, I mean, and Kai, let me add on the point about coal specifically.
Quickly, Ben, because I want to grab
Here, the Donald Trump wants to help coal, but he also wants to allow fracking, which is going to expand natural gas. The biggest problem for the coal industry right now is not anything to do with regulation. It's to do with low natural gas prices. And so, you know, he sort of made all these promises. But frankly, you know, if we allow more natural gas production, we'll push down prices. It's going to hurt the coal industry more than anything that came out of the Obama administration.
Yeah, because they can't compete. So, David in Manhattan, welcome to WNYC. Join us.
Hello, hello. First time listener, long time caller. No, bad joke.
Okay. What do you got, David?
So, yeah, thanks. So, under a Trump economy, I stand to lose access to student loan forgiveness and public service programs. I did relatively well under Obama. I got a few degrees. I recently graduated from law school. I'm pending admission to the bar of the state of New York to practice law. And there's something that actually factored into the law school applications process. It's referred to as LRAP, L-R-A-P, Loan Repayment Assistance Program. Now, there's a few different, you know, flavors and colors. But ultimately, for an average of 120 payments made in good standing after I come out of deferral, which will be in a few weeks or months, I've already started to get the reminder phone calls. After 120 months of payments in good standing, if I can establish some kind of public service employment representing clients who are trying to start community nonprofits, representing clients who, but for their inability to pay for access to the judicial system, actually have legal problems that they need help with, medical problems, landlord-tenant, and some kind of public service employment would make me eligible for a lot of different types of programs, including the possibility of partial or total forgiveness of outstanding debt. Now, I did pretty well. I have developed a debilitating addiction to groceries and ramen noodles, but I survived my associate's degree, my bachelor's degree, and my law degree by withdrawing every red and also every blue cent that I was eligible to withdraw in loans. I would spend dozens of hours every semester applying for the little nickel and dime penny ante scholarships to offset like half of the cost of one textbook. I have a pretty decent amount of debt from undergrad. My approximate student loan debt plus interest to date is between 43 and 44 grand. Law school by itself coming up on 210 for a grand total of about $250,000.
That is a big number, David.
it's a lot bigger than I would have hoped, but it is what it is, and I don't have any regrets specifically because it got me here. But you know, Trump during the primaries absolutely thought he meant it when he started making, you know, motions and gestures and, you know, underlying his speeches, talking about, you know, asking government debt holders, i.e. U.S. citizens with savings bonds, to take a haircut, which is a legitimate common practice in his former line of work. But we saw what happened with the debt ceiling crisis back in 2011, and, you know, that is going to fly a lot worse than Flubber did in the Nutty Professor movies.
But so, David, your central concern is you're staring down this debt, and you're not sure that you're going to get any help with it in a Trump world. And I do think that you know, a lot of folks had that concern in the campaign. I think it's part of why it came up so much on the Democratic side. This is the United States of Anxiety from WNYC and the Nation. I'm Kai Wright. Our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. I want to go to Rita on the Upper West Side. Hi, Rita.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Very interesting show. Well, I told your producer that the two ways I think will be affected is, number one, without the TPP or something like it, you know, because I didn't like all the details of that. China is going, which China wasn't involved in it, so now they're going to have a free rein to completely control the pricing and the tariffs and the terms of agreements among the Southeast Asian countries where a lot of growth is. So who knows if American companies will be able to invest there. You know, it's just a whole big unknown. And if the United States is not even involved in it, it's an even more unknown. So the Trump's determination to have absolutely no involvement, I think, is going to really endanger citizens of the United States. We won't be able to get a lot of things, number one. Plus, we export so much into that area, and there's so much in terms of manufacturing that goes back and forth, you know, like intricate parts are made here for the chips, for different computer parts, and then they're assembled overseas, and then they're shipped back here. So, you know, what's going to happen? Is that going to that whole network going to blow up? And who knows how many jobs are involved in that? So that's my first major concern.
Well, I'm going to leave it at that concern because I want to hear what Ben and Karen have to say about this. Karen, in particular, so trade. You know, there is now, some say, an opportunity for labor in particular to work with a President Trump on renegotiating some of these trade deals. Rita says she's scared that we would get out of TPP. Do you see any opportunities for better trade deals that would help the folks you work with?
Well, we're going to push better trade deals. It's not that we're opposed to trade. We're opposed to bad trade. We want fair trade deals. And if we can, and we intend to hold Trump accountable on this, that he says he's against TPP, so are we. But we also believe that there are good trade deals that can benefit American workers and American consumers and keep us in the global economy. You know, I agree, we need to be part of the global economy, but on better terms. And I think that a lot of what we need to do going forward is call the question on Trump. You know, he made a lot of claims, and then it's our job to say, okay, well, what are you going to deliver? Who are you going to deliver to? So we want to make sure that this deal is deep sixed and that better terms, that ones that genuinely support working families can be created.
But to push you a little on that, I mean, there is some dispute about this, about whether or not labor groups should in fact be sitting down with Trump. And I guess I want to hear, do you have faith that you could get something out of him, or that you just need to oppose consistently what he's doing?
I mean, I think the first thing is that labor has been out for a long time against TPP. Let's make sure that TPP doesn't go forward. Just speaking for working America, we've been out in the field talking to our members since the election, and, you know, there are people want to they want to see what happens next. And so I don't speak for all of labor, but I do
Sure.
know that we want to be able to talk to our members who are so disappointed about having lost the election. But we also want to talk to our members, and there were a lot of them who voted for Trump. They're not ideologues. They hope things are better. And we have a lot of doubts about whether anything is going to be better. I think what he said is terrifying in a lot of ways, but we have to prove that going forward. And I think that's what we need to do. We have a responsibility to voters to tell them the truth and to make sure that we bring people along around what Trump is really going to do.
So let's go to Amy in Piermont, New York. Amy, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
What would you like to tell us about?
So my concern, I run a 65-employee niche high-technology manufacturing business, and my concern is that President-elect Trump and the far right in general do not have an understanding of the ecosystem that starts with science funding and ends up producing good, high-quality production floor jobs for businesses like the one that I run. I'm really concerned that, you know, there's this immediate assumption that, science funding funds all kinds of crazy things and no real understanding or holistic view that that science funding trickles down in often not such a slow fashion to produce high-quality technical craftspeople production floor jobs. And I'm just really concerned that that ecosystem gets ignored for lots of different manufacturers in all different sectors. I happen to be in photonics, but it will apply across advanced manufacturing, 3D printing, all the different areas that are commercialized by virtue of U.S. government science funding.
Okay. Thank you for that, Amy. Ben, I actually want to back up to trade for a second for you. What about you? Do you think anyone can make a pro-trade case in this climate? Is there a reason to make such a case?
So, I mean, I think this is a really interesting and complicated area. You know, I think it's clear that there was a real backlash, both in the Democratic primaries against trade. You know, obviously Clinton came out of those in the end, but there was a very strong, you know, anti-trade push that supported Bernie Sanders, and then we saw it in the general election. And, you know, I think that reflects to a large degree some real frustration that we've heard for a very long time that, you know, trade is, from economists and from sort of moderates of both parties, you know, that trade is good. And I think that's true. You know, I think, you know, we heard Karen say just a moment ago that she saw, you know, we want trade. But there was sort of a poo-pooing of the downsides and the consequences. And you certainly heard that from economists who sort of said, you know, yes, of course there are people who are going to lose their jobs in factories, but they'll be able to find new ones. They'll be able to, you know, relocate to somewhere where good jobs come along, and you know, it's going to sort of further the economy, you know, with sort of short-term losses. And what we've seen in the last few years has been a real reevaluation of that by a lot of economists who have sort of said, you know, that the people who lose often lose bigger than we realize. The places that lose for a longer time than we'd realized. And that doesn't sort of call into question the basic positives of trade, but it does call into question sort of how widespread and how long-lasting the negative consequences are. And, you know, I don't necessarily have a lot of faith from what we've heard from Donald Trump so far that that's going to change, but I do think it forces a real reevaluation for both parties to sort of think about how do we ensure that the trade policies that we do adopt sort of recognize the reality that there are a lot of people who are hurt, you know, in kind of the medium term by some of these deals.
Karen, in 60 seconds or less, what is, if there's something you are either ambitious or optimistic about with the Trump election, a Trump presidency, or deeply scared about, what is the one?
Well, I'm not optimistic about anything about a Trump presidency, but what I am optimistic about is that there are Trump voters who are searchers. You know, they're the ideologues, they're the locker-up people, but most of them are people who are searching for solutions in an environment where they've just been shafted for, you know, a long time, and their families have no hope for the future. So the what's hopeful is that there's an opportunity to keep bringing them along. They are looking for progressive solutions just as much as while they're voting for Trump. We have to do a much better job of being a viable alternative. That's on the ground, individuals doing the organizing, but also better leaders.
I will have to stop you there, Karen. I have to stop you there. Thank you for that. Thank you for joining us, Karen Nussbaum, Executive Director of Working America, and Ben Kasselbaum, Senior Editor and Chief Economics Writer at 538.com. You've been listening to a special post-election live call-in episode of the United States of Anxiety, WNYC and the Nation's Election Series. Our call-in series continues weeknights at 8 o'clock through next Tuesday here on WNYC. You can find the United States of Anxiety series on our homepage at WNYC.org. I'm Kai Wright. Thank you and good night.